This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
In the news article itself, no matter how brief, they'll often mention that it is a totalitarian dictatorship, which is perfectly true. But you were supposed to believe that there's no reason for them to be doing that. So if I look at Japan Times, and they are using sources Bloomberg, AFP, JIJI, whatever that is, and AP. They have a slightly different report. They start off saying North Korea fired 3 short-range missiles Saturday, followed by imprecations versus North Korea. But then they write, the North launched 2 guided missiles in the morning and a 3rd in the afternoon, all headed northeast into waters off its east coast. South Korean Defense Ministry spokesman said from Seoul, the South Korea tracked and monitored the missile movements from start until end, said a presidential spokeswoman by phone. The launches followed joint South Korea-U.S. naval exercises involving the USS Nimitz, the aircraft carrier USS Nimitz, last week. Now that's the different part. That's the sentence that you did not hear from U.S. News. The launches followed joint South Korea-U.S. naval exercises involving the aircraft carrier USS Nimitz. Yeah, that's what it's about. And that's what all the previous craziness was about, is that we were doing our own craziness and provoking the hell out of them with nuclear war exercises. And, of course, the USS Nimitz is a nuclear-powered and nuclear warhead-carrying vessel. And when you hear that the USS Nimitz is doing something, that means that an entire group called a carrier group, a whole flotilla of boats, is doing something. Pardon me. Now, returning to the article, the headline of the article was, Display of Force After U.S. ROK Naval Drills Seen as De-escalation. Huh? What? And returning to their text, the short-range projectiles are a downgrade from a series of warnings from Kim's regime that the Korean Peninsula is on the brink of war. Using short-range missiles is a relatively restrained move by North Korea's standard, said Willie Lam, a professor at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. Unlike in April, when it was sending out hostile messages almost every day, North Korea has been more restrained in the past few weeks. End quote. Well, and that is certainly because the U.S. and South Korea have been more restrained in the last few weeks. And as large as it was, the war exercises with South Korean major capital ship and the USS Nimitz battle group was smaller than what was being done with B-2s and B-52s and God knows what earlier this year. Now, moving the Imperial Telescope to Iraq, this by Patrick Coburn in Counterpunch. Iraq is edging closer to all-out sectarian war between Sunni and Shia Muslims as a series of car bombings and shootings killed at least 90 people and left many others injured. Casualty figures are returning to a level not seen since the Civil War of 2006 and 7. Most of the car bombings targeted markets, bus stops, and other places crowded with civilians. A total of 10 car bombs killed 46 people and injured 150 in Baghdad. And another 2 bombs in the Shia port city of Basra in the south killed a further 13 and injured 40. In the town of Balad, north of Baghdad, a car bomb exploded next to a bus carrying Iranian pilgrims, killing 6 Iranians and 1 Iraqi, a police officer said. Now, departing from the text, this would certainly be defined as a war if it were happening in the United States. You can imagine just how frantic everyone would be. 10 car bombs, and that's just recently. And, of course, we started it. Over non-existent weapons of mass destruction, as you may recall. In the overwhelmingly Sunni province of Anbar, Patrick Coburn writes, in West Iraq, 12 policemen kidnapped from a bus traveling on the main road between Baghdad and Jordan on Saturday died during a botched rescue mission. The policemen were reportedly all shot in the head, suggesting that they had been executed by their captors during an attempt to free them. The Sunni Arabs in Anbar, which sprawls across the west of the country, are increasingly in a state of armed rebellion. The security situation has deteriorated sharply since an attack by government forces on a peaceful protest by Sunni at Hawaija in Kirkuk province on the 23rd of April, in which 44 people were killed. 8 policemen, including 2 officers, were killed in an attack on a police station in Haditha yesterday, And a further four police were killed and three wounded in an attack by tribesmen in Rabwa. Both places are in Anbar. On Saturday, in the provincial capital of Ramadi, security forces tried and failed to arrest a Mr. Mohammed Khamis Abu Risha, nephew of a powerful tribal leader, alleging that he is connected with the killing of five soldiers. Armed tribesmen fought back to prevent the arrest, during which two people were killed. Now, departing from this article again, not only did the U.S. invade and bomb the hell out of Iraq, and if you go back a little further, starve Iraq and prevent medicines coming to Iraq, the U.S. most definitely set Sunni versus Shia in Iraq. This is an ancient rivalry. It was worsened by groups of men running from mosque to mosque and blowing them up in the name of the opposing faction. And these men were set in action by the United States. And this is the result, the intended result. Also, the Shia are now in charge. Even though they're aligned with Iran, the U.S. put them in charge because the Sunni had been in charge before. A nasty situation, and we are entirely to blame. Now turning to Syria, this article by Bill Van Auken, and the World Socialist website, which is WSWS.org, he wrote, well, there's going to be lots of comments by yours truly, and I'm just going to mix them in right here. So let's plow through this, shall we? While ostensibly touring the Middle East to discuss a U.S.-Russian proposal for peace talks between the Syrian government of President Bashar al-Assad and Western-backed rebels, Secretary of State John Kerry met with U.S. allies to prepare for region-wide war, stopping first in Oman. Kerry held talks with the ruling Sultan, one of a string of monarchical dictators that constitute, together with Israel, the foundation of U.S. influence in the Middle East. The Secretary of State's visit coincided with the signing of a $2.1 billion deal between the Absolute Monarchy and Raytheon Corporation for the sale of advanced weapons systems, including Avenger fire units, Stinger missiles, and advanced medium-range air-to-air missiles, part of a ring of steel that Washington has sought to erect around Iran. So, departing from that, Stinger missiles again. Gee, where did Stinger missiles get us the last time? Stinger missiles were sold to the Afghan resistance, many of whom became the Taliban, or were the Taliban. Anyway, returning to the text, from there he flew to Amman, Jordan, that's Kerry did, for a meeting Wednesday of the Friends of Syria, U.S. Coalition of the Willing. That is, where have you heard that phrase before? It's fomenting the war for regime change in Syria. It consists of Washington, its European NATO allies, led by Britain, Turkey, Egypt, and various sheikdoms and sultanates of the Persian Gulf, including the major arms suppliers to the anti-Assad militias, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. By the way, have you ever wondered why those places are kings? Why they are feudal systems? Can't those people just get it right? Well, at the close of the Ottoman Empire, there was a parliament. There were attempts at parliaments, and the more thuggish groups, the people who later became kings, were set up as kings by U.S. and British State Department and oil personnel, because they thought maybe it'd be better. And if you look at their writings, there was a whole lot of racism involved, and they just thought it was better for those people to dispense with parliamentary democracy altogether and be ruled by kings. And so you have kings in Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and call them sheikhs, call them emirs. But they're kings, the very thing that Thomas Jefferson seemed to abhor. But returning to the article, once again, this is from WSWS.org. If you want to look it up, by Bill Van Auken. As the conference was convening Wednesday, Syria's ambassador to Jordan held a press conference to denounce it as a meeting of Syria's enemies. Those who want to end the tragedy in Syria need to stop arming and training terrorist gangs in Syria. The war in Syria is unprecedented. That's a quote of Bajat Suleiman, the ambassador. Representatives of the Syrian National Coalition, the anti-Assad front cobbled together by the U.S. State Department, were invited to the meeting only at the last minute. It appears there was some doubt if an agreement could be reached on whom the rebels would accept as their representative. The U.S. has promoted Gassan Hitto, a Texas, I'm not even making up his name. His name is Hitto, a Texas-based businessman linked to the Muslim Brotherhood who has lived in the U.S. over 30 years as a premier of a transitional government. Yeehaw. There have been increasing reports, however, that his role is strongly opposed by the Sunni sectarian militias that are fighting in Syria. It was reported that the coalition's acting chief, George Sabra, a former member of the Stalinist Syrian Communist Party, would stand in for the rebels. Well, how embarrassing. Oh, my goodness. While the State Department claims that Kerry's role in this gathering is to prepare for Syrian peace talks, dubbed Geneva II, which Washington and Moscow have publicly agreed to support, it is evident that the real agenda occupying the U.S. and its allies is how to salvage the war for regime change under conditions in which the Syrian government is inflicting strategic reverses on the Western-backed forces. And just me talking again, isn't it a funny thing that the U.S. should oppose Assad when he was just so handy for torturing the crap out of people for the United States of America? Yeah, our good buddy there. Don't know what to do with this guy? Well, grab him in Canada and ship him off to Syria to be tortured. Who needs that damn habeas corpus liberal stuff anyway? Well, returning to the article, this has emerged most clearly in the Syrian army's overrunning of the city of Qusar in western Syria. Boy, did I massacre that name, but anyway. Hey, I'm going to try it. Let's see. The city of Qusair. The city of Qusair in western Syria. That's not too, well, anyway. Just 8 miles from the Lebanese border. The town, which had fallen under control of the Western-backed militias, has served as a key pipeline for arms and foreign fighters crossing the Lebanese border. Rebel control of the surrounding region also threatened to separate the Syrian capital of Damascus from the city of Aleppo, as well as the Syrian coast. Speaking at a news conference in Amman at the opening of the Friends of Syria meeting, Kerry warned that if the Assad regime failed to negotiate a political solution, Washington would consider, get this, growing support for opposition in order to continue the fight for the freedom of their country. Yeah. Freedom of their country, that's the way he's talking. Funny, seems like a whole lot of people the United States likes to blow up are fighting for the freedom of their country. But, you know, any port in a storm? With U.S. officials demanding Assad's ouster as a condition for any settlement, it appears that the proposed talks will be turned into a pretext for escalating the U.S. intervention. Kerry's remark came just one day after the Senate Foreign Relations Committee approved by 15-3. A proposal for Washington to directly arm the opposition militias. The CIA is already coordinating the arms flows from the Gulf states and has reportedly organized huge shipments from Eastern Europe through third parties. Kerry blamed the reversals suffered by Washington's proxy forces in the battle for Qusair on the role played by fighters of Hezbollah, the Lebanese-backed party and militia that is aligned with the Assad government, as well as on alleged Iranian backing for the regime. Oh, the Iranians. Just last week, obviously, quoting Kerry, Hezbollah intervened very, very significantly. He also said there are several thousands of Hezbollah militia forces on the ground in Syria who are contributing to this violence, and we condemn that. End quote. Yeah, contributing to violence. Man, if there's one thing Kerry can't stand, it's contributing to violence. Hezbollah, returning to the article, has acknowledged that its fighters are in Syria, but has denied reports that they are playing any decisive role in the fighting, insisting rather they are training Lebanese and the Syrian border towns to defend themselves. I wonder where they got that line. Oh, yeah, it's just advisors we're sending into Vietnam. The Western media has also focused on Hezbollah's role, while ignoring the fact that large numbers of Sunni Islamist fighters have also come across the Lebanese border to fight against the Assad regime. The threat that this conflict will spill over the region's borders into full-scale regional war grows daily. In the northern Lebanese city of Tripoli, at least 11 people have died, including at least 2 Lebanese army soldiers, in clashes between Sunni militias and Lebanese Alawite supporters of Assad. The clashes have seen exchanges of mortar fire and rocket-propelled grenades, bringing schools, businesses, and other activities to a standstill. Yeah, that's Tripoli. The State Department issued a statement denouncing Hezbollah's role in Syria, charging that it serves to exacerbate and inflame regional sectarian tensions, which we would never do. No such denunciations were forthcoming when Islamic forces overran Qusair, decapitating and shooting members of the substantial Alawite and Christian minority populations in the area and forcing thousands to flee their homes. In one measure of the opposition's desperation, acting National Coalition Chief Sabra issued a statement on the eve of the Amman conference calling for the U.S. and its allies to open a humanitarian corridor to Qusair. In other words, to launch a direct Western military intervention on Syrian soil. And I can't beat this drum loudly enough. Direct military intervention. Once again, and returning to the article, in a conference call on Tuesday, a senior State Department official acknowledged one of the things we'll be talking about here in Amman tomorrow is what else needs to be done with respect to the military balance on the ground. They're talking on the ground. You know, those terms, on the ground, they're not on the table now, they're on the ground. In advancing its militarist agenda, Washington has stepped up a propaganda campaign charging that Iran is likewise responsible for the reverses suffered by the anti-Assad forces in Syria. A senior State Department official told the Washington Post that Iranian forces are fighting in Syria, repeating totally unsubstantiated allegations by the rebels as fact. As the Post pointed out, U.S. officials' allegation was a tacit acknowledgement that a two-year Syrian conflict has become a regional war and a de facto U.S. proxy fight with Iran. End quote. The Post columnist David Ignatius noted that while there is public talk of a peace conference in Geneva by next month, the battling on the ground is so intense and the demand for additional weapons from the opposition so vocal that a skeptical person should ask whether the Geneva talks will take place at all. Washington's ostensible agreement with Moscow, I like the way he uses ostensible. This is Bill Van Auken's work from WSWS.org. I just like ostensible. Washington's ostensible agreement with Moscow on peace talks is merely another tactic to advance its strategic aims in the region, which have been prosecuted through the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and now Syria. There's more on that, WSWS.org. Okay, now let's turn the Imperial Telescope close in to Boston. See if you can make sense of this. This is, you're going to have to put on your thinking cap for this. Okay, so Tamerlan Tsarnaev and his brother Jokhar show up at the Boston Marathon wearing backpacks. Okay, now we know what the backpacks were for, right? Pictures of young Jokhar, now analyzed, show that his backpack, could not have contained a 30-pound loaded pressure cooker. Nope, can't be done. Thanks to Stephen for that information. Checked it out. Yep. Couldn't have got a 30-pound loaded pressure cooker into that thing because the pictures show that it's just resting too lightly off one arm and not strained as it would be with that kind of weight. Not only that, post-explosion pictures show him, you know, young Jokhar, leaving with his backpack still on his back. Now, pardon me for grinding in the obvious, but you can't blow up a backpack while you're still wearing it and not get a scratch or two. Meanwhile, two huge guys from Kraft International, a.k.a. Houston Thugs R Us in the sense of hireable by, let's say, U.S. police and intelligence agencies. These guys from Kraft International are seen at the pre-blast marathon carrying backpacks that match the remnants later found at the scene. Match much better than Jokhar's. Gosh, I wish I knew how to say that. Jokhar. I'll just say Jokhar. I'm avoiding it because it sounds like the Joker. Maybe I should just go with that. Younger brother Joker. Anyway, no, there's just this little white square on them, and that's not on Joker's. That's on Kraft International's backpacks. So, as if this were not complicated enough, one of these guys from Kraft International can be seen in the pictures running away from the scene of the explosion, and he does not have his backpack. So that's a with several M's. And this week, Ibrahim Todashev was shot and killed while being interrogated by police and intelligence officials in an Orlando, Florida apartment. Todashev, a friend of Boston Marathon bombing suspect Tamerlan Tsarnaev, and like Tsarnaev, an ethnic Chechen, was reportedly being questioned by a Federal Bureau of Investigation agent from the FBI's Boston field office, along with Massachusetts state troopers and counterterrorism officials. With a knife on him. Yeah, because that's the FBI for you. They're just, you know, casual guys. Bring what you like. Got your knife with you. You want to bring your knife to the party? Oh, that's fine. It's FBI. Nobody thought to check him for a knife or a gun or a highly miniaturized pressure cooker bomb wallet or anything. The FBI claims that Todashev had implicated both himself and Tarnaev in the grisly murder of three men in Waltham, Massachusetts, a Boston suburb, on September 11, 2011. Just implicated himself, and suddenly he pulled a knife and tried to attack the FBI agent questioning him. The attack, according to the FBI, prompted the lethal shooting. What was that you were saying about Tarnaev, Mr. Todashev? Mr. Todashev. Funny, I can't hear you, Mr. Todashev. What's that? You support Assad? I think he said he supports Assad. I can tell by the way he's bleeding. So if you can make sense of that, good luck with that. And you're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. News you're not supposed to know. The city of Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and its neighbor Knoxville are government towns. Oak Ridge has been called the closed city, reminiscent of government cities in the old Soviet Union that were closed to the public because of sensitive weapons production and other activities the Soviets wanted to keep from prying eyes. In the case of Oak Ridge, Tennessee, the U.S. government wants to keep the production of nuclear bombs and their components away from public scrutiny. This is an article by Ann Wright in Alternet.org. Oak Ridge is a tough place to challenge. The biggest employer in the area, a southern town, where dissent is abnormal and prejudices of all sorts run deep in the culture and the heritage. 9 months ago, on July 28th of last year, three persons with a snip of four offenses found themselves in the Oak Ridge nuclear weapons complex beside the most sensitive and dangerous of all buildings in the nuclear weapons program of the United States, the Highly Enriched Uranium Materials Facility, also known by its acronym HEUMPF. Sister Megan Rice, an 83-year-old nun from Washington, D.C., Michael Wally, 63-year-old veteran, two tours in Vietnam, now a missionary for a Dorothy Day Catholic Worker House in Washington, D.C., and Greg Obed, 57, a Vietnam-era Army medical officer and now a Minnesota house painter, were arrested and charged with harming the national defense and causing more than $1,000 damage to a government facility. The defendants had no thoughts of asking for a venue in any other place. This company town, Oak Ridge, Tennessee, is where exposure to different ideas about nuclear weapons should happen, they believe. There were 70 prospective jurors called for jury duty. Most have government backgrounds, family members or friends who had worked for the government. Only three had ever been to any type of protest, march, or demonstration of any issue, despite nodding affirmatively that he or she would be able to vote not guilty if the government did not present evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that the elements of the charges had been met. One would hazard an opinion that each juror knew that crosses would be burned in their yards, children would be shunned at school, and they would be stigmatized for the rest of their lives for voting not to convict the defendants, those challenging the nuclear weapons of their city and their country. So the three defendants went on trial for harming the United States national defense and causing physical damage to a defense facility in excess of $1,000. In the early morning of July 28th, three defendants prayed in a church parking lot, walked a few hundred yards, snipped some fences, didn't find any security, stopped them, walked ahead, climbed up a hill on switchbacks because one of them was 82, had a heart condition. After frequent stops, the group finally emerged at the top of the hill. Since no patrol had come to stop them, they kept moving down the hill towards the complex in the valley, called by the spirit, they later said. They encountered three more fences, so they had bolt cutters. Cut through them all. No problem. That's the nuclear weapons protection, and that's the craziness of the United States. You've been listening to Press Watch. Stay tuned, because coming up in just a couple of minutes, it's time for Linda Olsen Osterlund. And then there will be more of the KBOO Morning Radio Zine. Don't you dare miss it.
Station Navigator Report, May 17, 2013. KABU's strategic planned goal of being a regional media center is becoming a reality. At a recent gathering I attended in Ashland, Oregon, of Oregon community radio stations, I suggested several activities for the newly formed Oregon Community Media Consortium to collaborate on, with KABU assuming a mentor and leadership role. The emerging OCM will partner to produce statewide programming with content supplied by contributing community stations, and KABU will produce the final piece. We will pursue grant funding for a shared part-time reporter stationed in Salem to cover legislative issues. Each community station is receiving underwriter training and information from KABU to begin raising business support and revenue for their station efforts. And perhaps the most exciting collaboration is the OCM is going to be able to rebroadcast the 2013 Waterfront Blues Festival in their own communities on their own frequencies, helping to raise money for the Oregon Food Bank and awareness about hunger in our state. This is super exciting, and KABU is extremely proud and honored to be part of the Oregon Community Media Consortium. Stay tuned for more.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to A Deeper Look here on KBOO. I'm your host, Linda Olsen-Osterlund. Our topic today is resistance ecology and its first annual conference coming up on May 31st at Portland State University. I have three guests with me here in the studio, all organizers of the conference. There's Justin Kay with the organization Resistance Ecology. It's not just a conference, it's a new organization and movement. And he's also been with the Student Animal Liberation Coalition at Portland State University. There's Tim Hitchens, a longtime animal rights advocate. I guess you are an advocate of the rights of animals and an activist and a member of the resistance ecology movement as well. And then we have Josh Harper. You may have heard of him. He's a longtime animal liberationist who's been the target of government attention more than he would like to have been, including subpoenas, arrests, and 3 years in prison as a member of the Shack 7. It's a very important historical case where people were locked in jail on a basis of conspiracy, not ever being accused of actually taking any actions or even actually conspiring, in that there was no evidence that they actually talked to each other to commit any kind of crime. And nonetheless, several of them have spent a bunch of years in jail, something that we should all be concerned about. We're going to start with talking with Justin Kay to give us a little background about the Resistance Ecology Conference. I got very interested in it because it wants to bring together disparate groups and form new ways of organizing so that organizations who usually don't talk to each other very much reach across and begin to recognize that they have the same opponent. So, Justin, go ahead.
Thanks, Linda. My interest personally in getting involved in a movement like this with a perspective like this is kind of comes from my experience primarily with animal rights activism and a little bit of environmental stuff in the region. And I'm younger. I'm kind of a new generation of activists as well. So,
And by that, he means he's younger than the last generation of activists, which are really only about 10 or 15 years older than him, and I'm older than them.
Yeah, that kind of.
But he's the newest, and there are new ones, and it's important.
And that's part of the perspective as well, as kind of intergenerational movement building, as well as inter-movement building. It's kind of a main component of the conference. Tim and I were working with the Portland Animal Defense League for 5-6 years or so in this town, and our work with that group began to consist a lot of working with other organizations in town, organizations like Rising Tide or Earth First or Oregon Jericho, which is a political prisoner amnesty movement. And through a lot of that, we began to kind of develop a lens that was a perspective on movement building that was more than just single issue politics. Animal rights movement and environmental movement has kind of been plagued a lot by single issue politics in its history. And also, given our perspective as a younger generation, we kind of saw how much that had, in conjunction with government repression, isolated the movement so much that it was seeming to become more ineffective and reinventing the wheel quite a bit. So we wanted to begin a dialogue and a discourse around what types of things and perspectives, what kind of novel ideas can be brought to the table in order to build a movement that would kind of build itself out of the isolation that had been more or less characterizing things recently.
Well, I think that's part of what was really important to me is that you wouldn't necessarily see social justice organizations and animal rights organizations in the same ballpark. In the past, you wouldn't have seen unions and environmental organizations together, but at the action in Seattle against the World Trade Conference, you mm-hmm. did. You saw the first time, 50,000 union people come together marching with people carrying signs with whales on them. It was a very important step, and yet there's been a lot that's happened in the past 10 years or 11 years since then. I want to go to Josh. Josh, fill us in, because you've been personally one of the targets of this, the context in the nation around animal rights advocacy. There's the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, is that what it's called? I don't have it in front of me here, but there's been special laws developed just to go after animal rights advocates, and they're pushing new ones every day. And the repression has been pretty hard. Can you kind of set the context of this conference in that?
Absolutely. I think one thing that people really need to consider when they think about politics in the United States is that on average, you can pick the winner of an election 9 out of 10 times just by seeing how much money they have spent. And obviously, this money has to come from somewhere. In the United States, the biggest lobbyists are, number one, the pharmaceutical industry, and that's followed by